WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In 1984, Elmo Patrick Saunier was executed for killing two young people he had abducted from Lover's Lane with his brother. My guest sister, Helen Prejean, was Saunier's spiritual advisor. Since his execution, she's continued to work with death row inmates at the Louisiana State Penitentiary in Angola and to publicly oppose the death penalty. She says a person's humanity transcends the worst act he has ever committed. Sister Prejean is a Roman Catholic nun. Her prison work dates back to 1982. She was living and working among the poor in a New Orleans housing project when a member of the prison coalition asked her if she would correspond with a death row inmate. The inmate was Saunier. The correspondence led to visits. The visits led her to an enduring commitment to working with men facing execution. She's written a new book about her work called Dead Man Walking. Before Saunier was executed, Prejean came to believe it was his brother who killed the young couple. We talked about her work, and she told me about her very first visit to death row.
I was traumatized by my first visit, I have to tell you. I was frightened. First of all, the sign you read as you go in saying that, you know, by coming onto the prison property, you subject yourself to a strip search and your body cavities and dogs and the whole bit. And it's like it traumatized me. And I kept thinking, oh, God, maybe because I'm a nun, they'll cut me some slack. But I wasn't sure. And then as they brought me into the prison itself and onto death row, just to see the building and know that it was a building devoted to housing people who were condemned to die and waiting to die. And then when I saw, as the guard and I rounded a corner, and there were these red block letters over a green door with bars, and it said death row. I still remember seeing those words for the first time. Like, here is a section where condemned human beings live and wait to die, wait to be killed.
Can you tell us what your first meeting with Saunier was like?
I'll never forget it. I was pacing up and down. Well, they locked me in a room after they had brought me through all these gates, and I was pacing up and down because it was September. It's still hot in Louisiana in September. There's a huge fan going, and I was looking in these six booths. They look like telephone booths with heavy mesh wire to separate you from the prisoner. And I was just pacing. I had on my little heels, and I could hear the clop of my heels back and forth on the cement floor. I was a little afraid of him. I'd seen a picture of him, and it had shown him kind of scowling, and the picture had scared me. And I remember thinking, I'm glad he's in prison. I don't want him to be executed, but I'm glad he's in prison. And so I paced up and down and waited, and then I heard his voice coming down the tier with a guard, teasing the guard, because he was a Cajun. I could hear this Cajun French accent. And I heard his voice before I saw him, and I could hear the chains. His legs were shackled. I could hear the chains as they came across the floor. And then I looked up, and there he was. And he had showered, and he was shaved, and his hair was combed, and his face was so open. And it had a kindness in it and a gratitude. And he said, "Sister, I am so glad to see you," because I think he hadn't had a visitor in over 6 or 9 months. And then I eased up a little bit because he was so glad to see someone that he talked a lot. And I realized that all I had to do was really listen and be present to him.
Do you have to believe in somebody's innocence to work with them?
No. In fact, I went in assuming that he was guilty. I go to death row assuming that people are guilty. But to me, one of the moral issues of the death penalty is not so much whether or not we will not execute the innocent, but it's how do we treat the guilty. That, to me, is the moral question that we face with in the death penalty.
You work with prisoners and with families of their victims. Do you sometimes see the prisoners differently after you've spoken with the families of the victims and you've tried to empathize with them and see the crime through their eyes and see the prisoner through their eyes?
Yeah, it produces, I would say that it's probably the worst tension that I've ever felt in my life, is to have been with the victims and known their pain and their grief, and to walk in the room with the person who murdered their child. Because I feel them inside of me, and partly the way I feel their presence is that I have to fight back the guilt of being compassionate to someone who has done so terrible a thing. But the life forces are stronger than the hate forces. And granted, this is easier for me to say than them. If there's a hero in the book, it's Lloyd LeBlanc, who forgave the people who murdered, you know, his son. He knelt by his body's, the son of his body, and said, "Whoever did this, I forgive them." But it's a terrible tension. And I feel in myself the social pressure that the death penalty is. And I can understand how victims' families, they've lost someone they love so much. And here society says to them, "Well, because we value the life of your child, which has been so terribly taken from you, we want to exert the maximum penalty. How do you feel about that?" Well, all that love comes to bear, and you say, "Yes, the maximum penalty," because the maximum penalty is a measure of how much you loved your child. I think the formula gets written out that way, and people respond to that. In fact, I know of there are some murder victims' families who are against the death penalty that call murder victims' families for reconciliation. And Marietta Yeager, who's one of those people, her daughter, 9-year-old daughter, was brutally murdered. And she was on a talk show one time with some other victims' families who wanted the death penalty, and she did not want the death penalty. And at the end of the talk show, one of them said to her, "It's a shame you didn't love your daughter the way we loved ours," because that love is translated into people wanting the death penalty. And I see it as one of the factors that would make victims' families say, "Yes, of course we want the death penalty."
Is this the kind of thing you might talk about with parents of victims?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, we talk about everything. I mean, there are two stories I tell in the book were about two people who were executed, Pat Saunier and Robert Lee Willie. Pat Saunier's victim's family, one of the victim's families I have grown close to. With Robert Lee Willie, a young woman was brutally raped and murdered, Faith Hathaway, and her mother, Elizabeth Harvey, and her stepfather, Vernon Harvey. When we would be doing marches and campaigns against the death penalty, the Harveys were always waiting for us at the end of every march we did, and they had a sign that said, "What about the victims?" And Vernon Harvey said to me one time, he said, "Here you are, you've given all your time to these scum. Why don't you come with us to parents of murdered children and come with us to the victims' meetings, and you need to find out what the victims are going through." And he was right, and I went with them. And I was amazed at these meetings that I went to of what the victims' families have suffered. First, I was amazed that they felt abused by the criminal justice system as well as people in prison. Their phone calls weren't returned. In a way, I could see that the prosecutors who were going after the death penalty, it was the state versus the defendant, and the victims were out of the loop of the whole process. And so they didn't know how to deal with victims. Victims are not a vital part of the criminal justice process in prosecuting for the death penalty. And then they had to go through the trial. Of course, DAs, when they press for the death penalty, they want that victim's family there in the courtroom, even if they don't say anything. Their presence say, "Remember us, remember our child," and that's an argument, really silent, but an argument for the death penalty. And I see that the death penalty process, they have to go through the trial and relive it, then they have to wait for the appeals, and it's hard for them to find closure of their grief. It may be delayed 6 years, 7 years. I remember one time a victim's family, before Dalton Prejean was executed, she said, "When will our grief end? When will this execution take place?" And of course, what the state promises victims in Louisiana, victims' families can witness the execution. And what they say to them is, "Okay, your child's life has been taken. Justice will be done. We will allow you to witness the execution, and then you will experience justice and vindication for your child's life." And one of the stories in the book of the Harveys, of Vernon and Elizabeth Harvey, Vernon and I both witnessed Robert Lee Willie's execution. I was there as his spiritual advisor. Vernon and Elizabeth were both there to watch him die as the parents. And then afterwards, there were a lot of media people there, and the TV people came up to Vernon Harvey with their mics, because he had publicly said, "I can't wait to see him fry," you know. And they said, "Well, Mr. Harvey, you watched Robert Lee Willie die. How do you feel now?" And he said, It felt good to see him die. And then he added, the son of a bitch died too quick. I hope he burns in hell. And I have been visiting the Harvey since then. It's like I realize he could have watched Robert Lee Willie die 1,000 times and he still has to deal with the loss of Faith, his daughter, and that nothing can ever replace her.
Yeah. The first execution you witnessed was the execution of Elmo Patrick Saunier, who was also the first death row prisoner that you worked with.
Right.
Did you decide to watch or not watch when you were in that room as the electric chair was turned on?
When Pat and I had talked about it, first I was shocked that he was going to be executed. I just never dreamed it would happen because we hadn't had many executions in Louisiana. You know, this was in 1984. And so I said to him one time, I said, well, Pat, if you do die, I will be there with you. I want you to be able to see a loving face. And he went, oh, no, sister. He said, you know, that could harm you. This is going to be terrible. And I went, no. There's no question about it. I will be there with you. Then when I was actually in the chamber, I walked with him, you know, to the chair and read the scripture from Isaiah 43. If you walk through the sea, I'll be with you. God's words of comfort to him. And then they brought him into the execution chamber, and I was right behind him, and I kissed him on the back. I was leaving him, and I said, Pat, pray for me. And he turned around, and he said, Sister Helen, I will. And then I went and sat in the witness chamber, and he could see me. He could see my face. And they strapped them in. They strapped the trunk and their legs and their arms. And he reached out his hand to me right before they strapped his right arm. And his last words were to me, I love you. And I remember my arm just raising up, going toward him, saying, I love you too. But then they put a mask over his face. That's to protect the witnesses from the sight of his face when the 1900 volts would hit his body. I knew he couldn't see me anymore, and he knew I was there. And so then I shut my eyes as they pulled the switch.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sister Helen Prejean, and she's the author of the new book, Dead Man Walking, An Eyewitness Account of the Death Penalty in the United States. She works with prisoners on death row at the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola, and also sometimes works with the families of the victims. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Sister Helen Prejean, who works with prisoners on death row at the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. She's the author of the new book, Dead Man Walking. The second prisoner on death row who you began communicating with was Robert Willie. And the first time you went to visit him, he asked you about being celibate, and he asked you if you miss having a man. Those strike me as really suggestive, intimate questions, and I don't know, I think if I were in your shoes, I would have really distrusted the motives of the person asking the questions. How did you handle it?
Well, Robert Lee Willie, I would characterize him as a true outlaw. I mean, he had a swastika on his arm. He belonged to the white Aryan supremacy. He held up Hitler as a hero. He said he hated all people of color. And he said to me one time, I'm not just prejudiced against blacks, but against, he named them off, spicks, chinks. It was just amazing to me, you know, hit the background and the way that he thought about things. And when we had that conversation, but first of all, I was really kind of hoping when I wrote to him that maybe he didn't want a nun to be his spiritual advisor because he said he never was particularly religiously inclined. And so I wrote to him, but halfway hoping, well, Robert Lee Willie, God, such an outlaw. Surely he is not going to want me, okay? But nope, the letter came back. He said, glad to have the company, and I would like for you to come. So I went. And actually, the tone of that conversation was, it was more he asked it to me really like an amazing question, that somebody would live a celibate life without sex. I mean, it was more like amazed that anybody would even try to do this. And the tone of voice in which he talked to me about it was, you know, one of, you know, God, I love women. He said, I believed in doing it. We'd get us a bottle of bourbon and a blanket. And it was not that you would have to have guests have been there to hear the tone of it. But he just said it in a matter-of-fact voice like that. And then he, and then that was when I said to him, Robert, you know, by my vow of celibacy, it's like, you know, it's not that I don't love anybody. It's that this way I can spread my love in the human family and not be confined to just one person and one family, like visiting somebody like you. And he kind of laughed and he says, yeah, he says, I know what you mean. And I only had 2 months with him before he was executed. And there are many very interesting conversations, which I tried to record very exactly in the book, because he was such an unusual person. And I'd never dealt with anybody quite like him. I was very honest with him, too, about confronting him with the heinousness of what he had done, the terribleness of it.
Okay, so here's somebody who's, you know, not only a white supremacist, but also committed these horrible crimes. And the more details you hear about his personality, the more truly reprehensible
Absolutely.
He becomes. So what kind of relationship did you want to have with him? What did you feel you could do for him? And what did you find anything in him that transcended all these horrible things that we've been discussing?
One of the things I did with Robert Willie was I was just very straightforward with him. I just said, you have committed one of the most heinous crimes imaginable to human beings. I mean, look at Faith Hathaway stabbed 17 times and raped and her parents. See, because one of the things that happened with Robert Willie is that Vernon Harvey was getting, he was holding his own press conferences and saying publicly how he couldn't wait to see Robert Willie die. And
Vernon Harvey was a step-parent of one of the victims.
The stepfather of Faith Hathaway. And so Robert Willie got into that with Vernon Harvey, saying, well, like, he's his own worst enemy, man. He ought to just let this go. I mean, he's saying he ought to let this go when, I mean, this was such a terrible crime. He and Joe Vaccara had participated in this. And I'm saying, let this go. What are you saying? Do you realize, like, what these parents have suffered? And then I asked him, I said, suppose somebody did this to your mother. How would you feel? He said, I would want him executed. I mean, he didn't even hesitate. And then he got off on the thing of that anybody that kills children, he would want to see them executed. Like, he had his own code, too. Anyway, and I just said to him, Robert, before you die, if there's one thing, it's you need to apologize to these people. You know, you need to tell them in some way that you're sorry for what happened to their daughter. And one of the things I bring out in the book is, see, the death penalty, he was fleeing for his life in a way, but trying to be tough, because he's under the gun now. Somebody's after him trying to kill him. And I find that it's harder to experience remorse when he's in, like, flight with his own life. His own life is being threatened, and he knows he's going to die. So he's trying to put up this tough Marlboro Man front. And I think his harshness and the way he was talking about Vernon Harvey was part of that.
So, but in all honesty, it sounds to me like he doesn't have to put up a front. I mean, he is hardened. He doesn't have to fake it.
Well, a couple of things happened with Robert Willie, though, before he died. One of them was, at one point he said to me, well, okay, he said, one thing I do hope for sincerely, I hope my death gives the Harveys some peace. And I seized on that. I said, at least you're saying there that by your dying, you hope that they will have peace. And in fact, before he was executed, his last words were to them, and he said, I hope my dying gives you peace.
When you witnessed Saunier's execution, you closed your eyes. What about when you witnessed Robert Lee Willie's execution?
Well, it's like I had been through it once, and so then when I was with Robert Lee Willie, I was there as a witness, and I had more strength to me because I had been through it once, and I watched everything with Robert. I didn't close my eyes, and I watched, and as the current hit his body, see, they strapped their chin close, very tight, to hold their jaw together, so they're really silent, they can't speak, and they have their body strapped in the chair, and as the bolts hit his body, his whole body, like, heaved in the chair, and the straps contained him, And I remember thinking to myself, it takes a long time to make a human being, and it only takes a few seconds to turn it into trash. Not that I condoned in any way what Robert Willie did. What he did was atrocious in any way that we can in our society. I do believe that people who commit such violent crimes need to be imprisoned, long-term imprisonment. But to watch such a premeditated, violent taking of human life, I was just so struck by how wrong that was. In the first execution, you know, Warden Maggio, when he announced the time of death, his eyes happened to meet mine, and he lowered his eyes. And, you know, partly what I tell in Dead Man Walking is my encounters with all these people in the process, from the warden, the governor, the head of the pardon board, and most of the people I encountered in that process who had to carry it out did not feel good about what they did. They felt some shame.
The electric chair in Louisiana has been abandoned for lethal injection. Many people find lethal injection more humane. Do you think it makes a difference?
God, I mean, I bring that out in a book. You know, if you're on a gurney waiting for three chemicals to kill you, one to stop your heart, the other to stop your breathing, or if you're waiting for an electric current, or you're waiting for a bullet, or you're waiting for gas, it's like the terror of death. The torture in the death penalty is the waiting to die. And Amnesty International has defined torture as an extreme mental or physical assault against a person who's been rendered defenseless. The Eighth Amendment forbids us to practice cruel and unusual punishment. And the killing of a human being consciously like this is the practice of torture. It is mental torture. What most death row inmates say by the time they die, they've been through the process maybe three times, being brought into the death chamber at times, maybe hours away from death, given a stay, brought back to begin the process over. And they say, you know, I am so tired preparing for death, their whole family going through with. It's torture. We need to have the honesty to admit that we torture prisoners before we kill them. But the U.S. Supreme Court refuses to do that. And now with the lethal injection, see, you have 21 states now who are doing lethal injection. It's like it's all covered over and made clean. In fact, an associate warden was saying at one point, well, the witness is going to be bored. He said, there's nothing to see. Like you're watching somebody go to sleep. And they have like a hospital, white hospital curtain around a gurney now. They cover him over with a sheet. They're trying to make it look like a hospital, like they're putting somebody to sleep, like a horse or something. They probably use alcohol on the person's arm before they put the needle in his arm for the IV, which is just, it's all a, we want life to be clean. We don't want any blood, and we don't want anything to look like torture. That's to save our own consciences, because it is torture and it is premeditated death.
Sister Helen Prejean is the author of the new book, Dead Man Walking. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.